From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. This week, NHPR has been looking at trauma in the time of COVID-19 in a series called Lifelines. And today, as part of that series, we look at one population in particular, refugees. Since the early 1980s, more than 7,500 refugees have been resettled in New Hampshire from over 30 countries. Most have had to leave their homes to escape violence and war and experience trauma before, during, and after relocation. Today in The Exchange, how trauma uniquely affects their experience living in New Hampshire, and now, in a time of pandemic, the ways they find resiliency and community. Exchange listeners, we welcome your questions as always. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. We have three guests. Zan Weber is with us, Chief Program Officer and Social Worker for the International Institute of New England, which helps refugees and immigrants with resettlement, education, jobs, and citizenship. Also with us, Carolyn Musimi Kamau, Manager for the New American Africans Program at the Organization for Refugee and Immigrant Success. And also with us, Clement Kigugu, Case Manager at Building Community in New Hampshire, formerly the Bhutanese Community of New Hampshire, also Chief Executive Officer at Overcomers Refugee Services. And welcome all of you. And Clement, I want to start with you. While all refugees who come to New Hampshire, as I said, from those 30 countries, have their own unique experiences, are there, Clement, certain common traumatic experiences that overlap across refugee communities? What do you think, Clement?
Thank you so much. But I want to just correct little things. I am not caseworker from Building Community of New Hampshire. I was their caseworker like 3 years ago, but I'm now Executive Director of Overcomers Refugee Services.
Great.
There's a, as you said, the common trauma among the refugee communities that we see in New Hampshire. So there's people who came as refugee. They have been in refugee camp for 10 to 20 years. And so they go to refugee camp after they left their country due to war, persecution, or religion, or race. And some of them lost their parents or children, or, you know, they have been executed in prison and stuff like that. So when they arrive here and in US, they still, you know, have some of them left their children in a refugee camp. So when they arrive here, they're still showing those trauma they had in refugee camp or they have in their countries, and it's still really showing here due to different things, because they live in the country when they don't have language. They have a new system that they are trying to manage, trying to understand. They are trying to understand the school system. They're trying to, you know, starting their new life, like having job, how to manage their houses, how to manage their life in general. So it's really overwhelming for the refugee or for someone who has the trauma, someone who lived in refugee camp for 10 to 20 years. And also, you know, having issue with the kids, for example, that trying to become American while they're still, you know, having the African cultures or struggling to learn the language. So there's a lot of things that really shows that they still have the trauma in their life.
Well, and Carolyn, I want to go to you next. What about that? Is there, recognizing the uniqueness of everyone's experience, are there certain common traumatic experiences that that most refugees share?
Thank you. Yes, there's common areas that refugees find challenges that are similar. For example, some of the refugees we serve come from countries that speak French. When they get here, the language is English. So there's the process of learning the new language, and also for their children who end up going to school here, some who stayed in the refugee camp were not going to school while they were in the refugee camp. So when they come here, they are placed in age-appropriate classes. So they have missed quite some time before they start class. And that can be very traumatizing for a young child to be in a class where they are not understanding what everybody else is learning. And on top of having an accent that is different from the rest of the students. So it takes some time for the youth and for the children to catch up with the classwork. There's also families that relocate here, but then their relatives are left in Africa. So you could find a wife who is here and their husband is still in Africa. So they were not relocated as a family. They were relocated in parts and bits because it's so many people who are getting help at the same time. So the important thing is to, first of all, make sure the ones who can come in are brought in first. So that separation also causes anxiety. I speak to some families who say, oh, my husband is in South Africa. Maybe they were relocated from Congo and some were taken to South Africa, others were brought to the USA, and they're still dealing with how to bring their loved ones to join them here in the USA. So that is one of the big issues that we face. And now, like now during this COVID-19, the language barrier is a big challenge because all the announcements sometimes will be in English. Some of the community members that we serve are not able to read English, so they'll need to go through a translator. And sometimes with translation, some meaning is lost in the translation. So one is not sure whether what they said is exactly what is translated. So trauma can show up in big ways where somebody is actually having a mental issue, or small ways where they're just feeling frustrated because what they hope to achieve is not what they are achieving. That is on top of learning a new culture, moving from one country to another, and now adapting to the new food, the new culture, the new way of doing things, and also missing how you lived your life, say in Africa or in Bhutan or in a different country. And that is why in the Organization for Refugee Success and Immigrant Success, we encourage the families to grow the foods that they grew in their home country so that it can give them a little bit of normalcy and reduce the impact of the change.
Wow. Well, and what you're saying makes it so clear that there isn't just the trauma that refugees suffer, you know, during war and during that long, long time in a refugee camp, but also the trauma of resettlement. And Zan, I want to bring you into this too. First of all, just your thoughts about the commonality, even though every refugee has his or her own experience, of course. What commonality do you see, Zan?
Great. Thank you, Laura. And it's great to be with you and Clement and Carolyn this morning. I just want to pull it back for a moment and just talk a little bit about the refugee program. You know, refugees come to the U.S. because they're invited by our country. We've always identified and cared about them. The state of New Hampshire has been incredibly welcoming. But they qualify for resettlement mainly because of the degree of persecution and suffering they've experienced in their home countries or in countries of asylum. So, you know, in a sense, the refugee resettlement program, it's a humanitarian program. And our response really as a country to some of the deepest trauma on earth. So, you know, I think trauma in itself, you know, is known as, you know, and understood as an emotional response to an event that's deeply distressing. I think many refugees have extreme events that are distressing and can show up in traumatic experiences and symptoms. But, you know, trauma is a common human experience. And I think in many ways, what could be common to refugee communities who are all different are that behaviors and expressions can be culturally specific or culturally nuanced. What we've seen in our work and at the International Institute, we have social workers and case managers and many services that are designed to sort of address a lot of different life areas, including education, employment, legal services, and programming, all really protective services, I would call them. What we've seen is many, like your guests have already shared, Carolyn and Clement, really many responses to what has, you know, carried with them from very deep, distressing experiences overseas. And some triggers and things that continue because of the, you know, the structure of the resettlement experience. For many people, trauma looks like, you know, flashbacks and anger and headaches. It can look like nausea. It can be psychosomatic, so that the body's manifesting what's happening emotionally. And, you know, I always think about, I think something that, you know, a clinician in Massachusetts coined this term, the body keeps the score. The body, you know, stores experiences that are both wonderful and distressing. Distressing experiences can affect brain development. They can affect attachment systems. And I think for many of our refugees, we see all of that showing up. We see it manifesting. But we also see there, you know, the people who are here are survivors, and they're able to carry and take from some of their experiences and some of their strength and move that all forward. In our program, we do a lot of work with some of New Hampshire's really great healthcare systems and their really dedicated public health system to connect people with really acute symptoms and acute issues to like mental health care and therapies. But, you know, and I'm sure we'll get into this, but we could also talk a lot more about what are some of the protective supports that refugee communities and families have.
Well, and Zan, I did want to ask you this, though. You talked about how trauma rewires the brain, and certainly the series that, you know, NHPR has been doing this week has looked a lot about that. I wonder, Zan, how do children who experience war or violence-related trauma, how do they process that differently from adults? Certainly children's brains are more flexible and plastic. And, you know, we often say children are adaptable, but we also know a lot now, Zan, about early childhood trauma and its impact on emotional and cognitive development.
Right. And I would say, you know, I mean, everybody's different. Every family's different. Their support systems are different. I think, you know, the immediate aftermath of what happens to a child in a traumatic experience and the way that that's contained by others and stabilized has a lot to do with their response. We definitely see trauma in children showing up with attachment issues where they can find it either very, very hard to attach and trust others, or find overly attached issues and separation anxieties. I think many children, you know, children who are here often, like you said, it's much easier and they adapt much more quickly to certain sort of new pieces of life, like language, sometimes friendships, sometimes community connections. But I think, you know, their children are much less capable of explaining in words and thoughts what's going and understanding their thoughts, what's going on with them emotionally. So I think a lot of what you could see is really some behavioral issues, deep senses of anger. It's very different for every person, but I think what we've found is it really often shows up as, you know, really an inability to use explanations and words, which actually could be hard, you know, for anyone. But oftentimes it can be much more specific to like behaviors.
I want to remind our listeners that you can join us. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at how trauma uniquely affects the experience of refugees living in New Hampshire, and now in a time of pandemic, the ways that they are finding resiliency and community. Exchange listeners, we always want to hear from you. We welcome your questions and comments. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. I want to turn to you first, Carolyn, on this, but hear from anybody. Carolyn, you first. What's positive in that first step of the process of resettlement? And how does that help refugees who may have experienced severe trauma? Carolyn, you talked earlier about, you know, how just resettling itself is traumatic. Language, family separation, long times in refugee camps. But what is positive about that first step, Carolyn?
First of all, it offers an opportunity to have a fresh start It also gives an opportunity for families to grow together. I've seen the youth advance in so many ways, go to high school, go to college, build a career, and start all over again, as opposed to if they stayed in that situation in a refugee camp where there was no hope and there was no certainty of what was going to be the next step in their life. And also for the parents, some of the parents were injured during war, others were injured and affected by trauma and by the effects or the aftermath of famine, of war, and other situations that caused people to immigrate as refugees. And coming to a country like this, you can see a psychologist, you can see medical doctors who can help you. Some people are injured, they lost body parts. You can get into a process where you are getting treatment and that is being addressed. And most importantly, where you can have that stability that gives you the ability to heal and to move on and to have a fresh start, develop a career, learn a new language. It's more difficult for the parents, as I said earlier, than for the youth. The youth tend to learn languages fast. We had a situation where one of the parents was told that this is not your child because they actually speak a different language. But what actually had happened is that in the refugee camp, the children learn languages from each other because some could be coming from Congo, others from Burundi, from Rwanda. So you'd find one child can speak in Rwanda, Lingala, and different languages. But for the parents, they kind of stick to the languages that they knew from the start. So that ability to learn and to integrate and to learn other cultures is very important for the youth and also for the parents.
Well, and Carolyn, you're clearly a parent working at home. That's the world we live in now. I think it's great. And we've heard dogs barking and doors slamming on other programs. And I myself am broadcasting from home, but I have teenagers. So, of course, they're still asleep. So yes. We're really glad that you're just trying to juggle it all and be with us today. Clement, I'd love to hear from you, too, on this question that I just asked Carolyn. What's positive about that first step in the process of resettlement, especially given the trauma that people have been through? I'm not trying to sugarcoat it. I'm just trying to ask you what you think about that that aspect of resettlement.
Yeah, thank you so much. I think there's a lot of positive in initial resettlement, as Carolyn and other people mentioned. You know, as I said, when the people left their country due to the war, persecution, and so when they left their country or their village and leave their family member, friend, and colleagues behind, and they leave their countries, they always go without anything except hope. So when they're in refugee camp and they stay for 10 to 20 years, their hope is just to find a place when they can be safe. So when they come to the third country, settlement country like US or other countries, so the first thing they feel like now we are safe, which is important in their life to help with the pre-trauma they have. And knowing that their children are now going to have their life, their dreams, as Carolyn said, you know, the kids now can go to school, they can graduate, they can pursue the career that they want and have their life and help their families in future. And also, you know, they even those who didn't have chance to go to school or the language barrier, for example, they're able to work and make money and live with other people from different countries, learning their different cultures. And also meet with different peoples, like volunteer, for example, that can, receiving community volunteer that interact with them, showing them they love them, they receive them, they give them most of the everything that they need. This really helps also their trauma to, you know, go down and feel better more than they were in back home or in the refugee camp they lives. The other thing in regard of the children, for example, that you mentioned, there's many kids, for example, who were born from the parents who were raped, or they just have the kids by force. And then the mother, sometimes they don't have a really affection to their kids due to the experience they had. And then when the kids born and grow, the mother will not really have the same affection. But if they get here, for example, they get some friend, some of them, they have a trauma. They feel like nobody likes us, nobody loves me. But when they have a friend around and they feel safe, they have a different program like sports, different program like a friend program, for example, where they have mentors, volunteer from different churches, the kids feel like they have someone who care about them. You know, they have parents, they have someone who can talk to them, they have someone who can take off their issues. It helps them to feel like now we are in place where we feel it's a home. It's a place where we can live. It's a place where we can work. It's a place where we can live longer and safe.
Because their lives have been so unsettled for so long. And actually, Zan, I did want to ask you this before we take a short break. Both of our other guests have mentioned long, long stays in refugee camps and how that in and of itself can be traumatizing. You know, you've already gone through the ethnic-based violence or the war or, you know, something terrible. So that's the first case of trauma or the first possible cause of trauma. Why, Zan, do refugees who come to New Hampshire, and I'm guessing all over the U.S., stay so long in refugee camps? I mean, people this hour already have mentioned 10 years, 20 years. Why is it so long, Zan?
well, that would probably require a very long answer. The refugee resettlement process and sort of structure across the world is very complex. And many groups of people and individuals who are identified as persecuted and meet the criteria and the definition of a refugee are a part of, you know, who the United Nations has identified for resettlement, but there are many fewer spots in the world or opportunities for resettlement than there are refugees. I think the last number I saw was 65 million refugees, and the world resettles less than 1% of them. Often when someone is in a war zone and maybe crosses into another country and that country will not allow them to stay, they're put in a refugee camp. And a refugee camp is negotiated across countries for a place to protect people while countries try to figure out what to do with them if neither country or no other country wants to create a permanent solution. So that can be a protracted situation, and it can lead to warehousing and people who are, you know, sort of in forgotten camps for years and years and years. The United Nations does, you know, a lot of work to help them survive, but that doesn't mean that they're, you know, that they're able to resettle them in countries that are willing to accept them. You know, it doesn't get a lot of attention now, but the U.S. refugee resettlement program was the largest in the world until more recently, and really does an incredible job all over this country of welcoming people. And you know, I would say the longer someone's in a protracted experience like that, the more complex the trauma can be. That means it's compounded, and maybe it's repeating itself. It could, you know, it leads to deeper and more challenging symptoms. But you know, I would say the New Hampshire organizations and communities like Clement and Carolyn are from, like the International Institute, are developed and designed after years and years and years of working with refugees and all types of needs and situations. And, you know, just getting back to your original question, I agree with Clement. You know, I think one of the symptoms of trauma is hopelessness, but we see people who are coming with hope. The refugee program offers an opportunity for hope. And then as soon as people are here, you know, it's a very under-resourced program. And, you know, I think we could all talk about how much support it takes and how much, you know, how much goodwill it takes to resettle people. But, you know, I think people do have new opportunities for resources, for education, for job training. Many refugees are here because of their children. They want to give their children a better life. And so, I feel like hope is that protective factor that is only available because of resettlement.
Well, coming up, we'll talk more about how the resettlement process works and where both trauma and resilience come in. Also, we'll turn to how COVID-19 is affecting refugee communities and the groups that try to help them. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. As part of Lifelines, NHPR's series on trauma, we're examining this hour trauma that refugees living in our state may face, and a little bit later, how the coronavirus pandemic uniquely impacts their experience trying to build a new life here in New Hampshire. Send us your questions by email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Zan Weber, Chief Program Officer and Social Worker for the International Institute of New England. Also, Carolyn Musimi Kamau, Manager for the New American Africans Program at the Organization for Refugee and Immigrant Success. And Clement Kigugu, he's Chief Executive Officer at Overcomers Refugee Services. Again, our number here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, as we've been talking about the resettlement process, what's positive, and the many aspects of resettlement that can cause trauma, this really gets into the work that you do. And Carolyn, you first, please. What is the first thing that you do when you're trying to help someone who has just gotten here to help them resettle successfully, especially given that, you know, they likely have been through some trauma? What's the first one or two things that you do, Carolyn?
I would like to start by saying that we are a post-resettlement organization. What that means is that we are not the first organization to receive refugees that come from from different nations. So once they get here, there is an intense program that is done by Accentria that helps deal with the initial stages of getting your housing, getting your kids to school, getting medical insurance, and all the things that you need when you get to a new country. After 8 months, it's expected that everybody will have gotten a job, they would have settled, they would be well situated to take off from there, maybe get a job, get insurance from that job, which is usually not the case. So that is where our organization and the Overcomers and other organizations come in to support the families. Because can you imagine, you're in a new country, you don't speak the language, and in 8 months you're expected to now start off on your own. So we give that now support of making sure if you have not learned how to drive well, we can take you to where the resources that will help you learn how to drive, like Second Start as a driving school. If your kids are in school and they had that gap in between, we have an after school program that can help you start to learn how to catch up with your homework. If you're having difficulties understanding things, we can discuss that. If you down the line need assistance with revising for your citizenship exam, then we can sit down and go over that together. Or even the youth, if they need assistance with revising their questions for their driving test, we can do that together. The parents sometimes will need assistance with navigating the system, getting to know, okay, when I go to the store, when I'm spending $1, what that does that mean in the currency of their country, and what amount of food will I get for this amount of money? So small things like those we continue to teach for some time. Some people are able to learn quickly. Others will take even up to 5 years to be able to settle well in their new
sure.
in their
Sure. It's just overwhelming in a way, and kind of amazing that people are expected to figure it all out in 8 months. Carolyn, to you first, but then I'll go to the others as well. How has the pandemic changed some of that work that you just described? Helping someone figure out shopping, helping someone figure out banking, helping someone figure out how to meet with their child's teachers. You know, all that sounds very sort of hands-on and face-to-face, and I just wonder how you're able to do that work right now, Carolyn.
It's very hands-on. Actually, like 2 weeks ago, we went to distribute food to the families that have been affected. And we had to do it by just buying the gift card and getting the families through the youth to receive this card so that then they can go and shop and buy whatever food they're missing in their households. So now things like the after school program, we usually also have a summer literacy program where we meet in Kitch Park, and we are able to help the kids read to each other so that they don't lose their reading skills during their summer program. Those we are going to have to do virtually. The parents who have phones and are available, they are not at work at the time that we have the program, will be able to give their kids this phone so that we can be able to continue to read. But it's truly very difficult, like the after school program where we can meet together with the youth and volunteers can come in to help. We are not able to do that at this time. Wow. Our agricultural program is going on where the parents are able to come to the farms and grow some crops. But again, we have to use protection, distancing, but this program is still on track. So that
you're outside, yeah.
Yes, well, they can make an income from that program. But for the youth, we kind of are either online, on the phone.
Sure, with possible limitations on the technology that's available. And Clement, I wanted to ask you the same question. I'm most familiar with the Concord School District, and the school district does a ton for new refugees, children of refugee families. And a lot of it is, you know, hands-on, face-to-face, and so forth. How is that type of support being carried out, Clement, now, given that everybody's supposed to stay away from each other?
Yeah, thank you so much. I want to just mention exactly what Overcomers Refugee Services do for the refugee. So we stand on three E's, which is education, empower, and engage. So as Carolyn said, we are post-resettlement agency. So we help the refugee after they have been here for 3 months up to 5 years or more than 5 years, which means the first step is done by resettlement agency like Accenture and International Institute. As the government, you know, found the for the resettlement agency for, you know, 6 to 8 months, and they assume that the refugee will be on their own. So that's where we really pick up from, and then we try to help them. So in educating and empowering refugee, so we help them to understand the culture and try to find a job for them, and then do the social services, which include all the medical, food stamp application, housing, but we also focus on hearing and peace building among the community themselves.
Right, as you I've seen know, that on your website, yeah.
Yes.
So how are you able to do that work now, Clement, though, given, again, limits on technology and given limits on face-to-face interactions?
Yes, so this program was a little bit challenged at the beginning, but yeah. Also were very successful due to this program educating and empower the refugees. So what we did is we put together a responding emergency team. So we work together by a grace of people who donated the money and New Hampshire Charitable Foundation and other grants that we get there. So we had the three interpreters from three languages, Swahili, Kinyarwanda, and Nepali. And so we were putting out the video showing people how they can do, for example, in employment, which was a big issue for the people to be able to manage an employment application. So we're putting the video out so that way people can see the procedure, how to do themselves. And we seen many people doing by themselves. They were calling us just to check, hey, I'm get stuck here. What do you want me, how can I do this? So we're helping them to go through their application. And also for the schooling, as you ask questions. So we have parents who, you know, do have some English and a little bit knowledge of technology. So what we're doing, we're posting all the posters from school, from governor's office and other places to translate in their languages and send to our website, Facebook page, and WhatsApp group. So people were able to read and follow up with the instruction, which I said was really, really successful for us. It's still a challenge, but it was successful for us because the people learn how to do the thing by themselves. So people have been learning how to pay the bills, for example, online, instead of, you know, going in and buy money order. So we're saying, how about for you open account and you get your card, I will walk through to pay your bills, for example. So connecting the DHHS, for example, Cochrane Hospital, giving them the line how they can be able to call and make appointment by themselves, by walking them instead of doing for them, but showing them how to do it. Which I would say was really a moment for us to educate our community. And it was very, very successful.
You know, speaking of that work that you're doing, Clement, and helping people find out the important messages and translating, I understand, Clement, you're a medical translator yourself, right?
Yes, I used to be.
Yeah. So have you been using those skills now, or are you just too busy doing other things?
Yes, I mean, I was helping the new interpreter. So when they translated the document and then they send it to me and I look over and then send it to our manager who managed the website to be able to post out.
All right. We got an email from Arnie who asks, please ask if there are significant numbers of refugees who are working in long-term care facilities where the risk of getting ill is very high. Arnie says, what is being done to make sure they have PPE? Again, that's the personal protective equipment. I think you already answered Clement Arnie's second question, which is, and are there people who speak languages other than the English getting adequate access for information? For example, how to apply for unemployment. Zan, can you answer Arnie's question, significant numbers of refugees who work in long-term care facilities? And Arnie, thank you for writing in.
Sure. And just to clarify, Caroline and Clement work mostly in Concord. There's large resettlement communities in Concord and Manchester, New Hampshire, and the Institute has our site in Manchester, and both Accentria Care Alliance and the International Institute do resettlement in New Hampshire. And so our services in Manchester are both very intense, immediate refugee resettlement services, as well as longer term post-resettlement support. So I think that we're really finding now that our programs are, you know, again, like others have said, have quickly shifted everything online. You know, I think our greatest challenge now is to make sure that our clients have, you know, stable and secure phone access, and that they're, you know, they can afford their cell phones so that we can get in touch with them. But we do have a lot of clients that are in healthcare and social services organizations. For example, we place a lot of people in our job training and programming into Easter Seals and some other facilities that are working with populations that are at risk. And so since we suspended on-site services on March 13th, we've distributed emergency services. The Institute itself raised over $110,000 for direct client support so that we can continue to support people's food needs and their rent. We're very, very worried that, you know, this population, every low-income population and family in this country is vulnerable right now. Many are losing their jobs. This population is a little, you know, has some extra layers of vulnerability because many of them are so new, and because of language, linguistic, and some cultural challenges. So we raised a lot of funding. We have incredible supporters in New Hampshire. We've been able to deliver a lot of basic needs and emergency need services. We have secured personal protective equipment. We've distributed to our clients. And then we're also in touch with their employers to make sure that they're doing all they can to protect them at work.
All right, Arnie, thank you for the question. And coming up after a short break, we'll take more of your questions and we'll talk a little bit more about trauma and how the coronavirus pandemic is specifically affecting New Hampshire's refugee communities and those who are trying to help them. That's all coming up. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, we're following up on the NHPR series on trauma with a focus on how refugees in the Granite State experience trauma and resilience, especially with the coronavirus pandemic. Exchange listeners, we'd love to hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. We've been talking to Zan Weber, Chief Program Officer and Social Worker for the International Institute of New England. Also, Carolyn Musimi Kamau, manager for the New American Africans Program at the Organization for Refugee and Immigrant Success, and Clement Kigugu. He's chief executective officer at Overcomers Refugee Services. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And all of you, we've been talking about the work that you do with refugee communities and the impact of trauma, the impact of resettlement, and also how the pandemic has affected the work that you are trying to do. And Clement, I wanted to go to you first. What about jobs? You and Carolyn both try to get refugees settled into jobs. What are you hearing from the people you work with, Clement, about the status of those jobs? Some people have been considered essential, healthcare workers, grocery store workers, but others have been furloughed or laid off.
Yeah. So we had some people who still really working, especially those who work in stores, healthcare facilities, and but the other people who were laid off, of course, it's really painful for them for the first time. You know, to stay home for a few weeks or months, but they're getting an employment benefit, but they're also waiting to go back to work after the thing goes normal. And there's a company around that has been really hiring, like those nursing and stores like Walmart, for example, and other places. So we have a few people, 20 to, you know, 30 people who went back to work in last week.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's a change.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Carolyn, to you, another aspect of this that we've been talking about with just everybody in New Hampshire is shifting family dynamics, given that some people are at home, some people are working in these incredibly stressful, essential jobs on the front lines. How have you seen, Carolyn, the pandemic affect the family dynamics of the families that you work with?
Even before the COVID-19, employment has been one of the big challenges for the refugee families, getting good, stable jobs that are consistent. And this emanates from the fact that language is a big barrier for most of the parents. There is hope because the youth now can speak English, they're going to school, and they potentially will get very good jobs and change that. But meanwhile, that topic of employment has been a big challenge because most of the families end up working in restaurants where they're not making enough money, or in stores, jobs that will give you the minimum wage. So that ends up not being enough. So most families end up working a lot of hours, and that has been affected now because you work in hotels, you're making beds there, or you are housekeeping in the hotel or in the hospital. At least the ones in the hospital are still working. But also it's still very dangerous because of the virus, and there's protection, PPE in their hospitals. I know you had asked about that earlier. That's what I learned from one of the families that works in the housekeeping. They are helping with the cleaning and all, and they told me they're getting enough of protective gear. So that was a big relief and encouraging. But I'm more concerned about the ones that work in the hotel industry, the ones that work in the restaurants, who have had to have either their hours cut significantly, and others who work in the factories also, hours cut significantly or losing their job altogether. So that is still a big challenge. And also another aspect, there are also some of the families that feel like if we start working, then we'll lose the benefits that we have of a free house, insurance. So there's also that part of the population that feels that way and kind of stays away from working. So this is a project that is still in the works, and we are hoping to get everybody to work once the COVID-19 is over. And also change of mind. One of the things that a refugee camp does to you, because of so many handouts over and over the years, you get to a place where you are used to those handouts, that the transition into a place where you are independent is challenged.
Carolyn, Clement talked about the challenges and the work he's doing in getting these health messages out, these important health messages about COVID-19 to the refugees he works with. How have you been getting the various health messages across to the families you work with, Carolyn?
Same thing. Translation. We are getting material that is translated into the different languages and distributing it to the families through. Most of our families we serve use an app that is called WhatsApp. So we send some of the messages through there, post on our Facebook page, make calls. I'm also participating in the census. So while we are giving out this information about census and how important it is for people to be counted, we are also putting in the information about the COVID-19. I talked about how we were distributing the food. We were able to reach 49 families. We were also able to give out this information. We print it out and give it to the families. And if they have a youth who is able to read English and translate, they are able to read for their parents, because some of the parents, even before they left their languages, they were not able to read and write in their native language. So even sometimes when things are translated and written on paper, it's still difficult for the parents. So we are relying a lot on the youth that we work with to translate for their parents and to make the message very clear, to know when they need to go and see a doctor, how to see a doctor, how to make that phone call, and all the necessary information. Where to get food, like this Saturday, the food bank. Yeah, the food bank is going to be have a mobile vehicle that will be delivering food. We have passed that information so that the families that may need to benefit from this service can be out there to receive the food and to have the masks on so that they're also protected if they get the food.
Oh, so that's interesting, Carolyn. So some of the adults that you work with can't read or write in their own language, and so translation, written translation, only goes so far for these people because they can't read, even if it is translated perfectly. Well, all of you, we have talked about, you know, trauma of the original refugee experience, the war and the violence, trauma in the refugee camps, and then some of the trauma that happens just in that resettlement process. On the flip side, and Zan, I'll turn to you first, what examples have you seen of refugees being more resilient in these times, given what they've already been through? And Zan, please take that first.
Sure. I'd say that many low-income communities in the U.S. and certainly immigrants who are refugees and coming to the U.S. and just getting started don't have much of a safety net. But refugees in particular, and at least many of the families and communities that we've resettled, have an incredible family and community network, and those really serve as safety networks for them. So resettlement is not usually an isolated experience. It's not usually one person from a refugee community who resettles. And if it's one, it's the first. So someone coming first and then hoping to reunify with the rest of their family. So we've had whole networks of refugee communities, Bhutanese communities, Congolese communities, Iraqi communities in the last several years who have come with extensive networks. And then those networks are able to really work with domestic and host communities to really sort of set up resources, establish connections. So what we see is, you know, being able to pool resources that helps retain some cultural identity, develop and support people as they're first here. Like Carolyn said, children helping parents with languages. These are really some of the ways I think refugees, when they're resettling, even, you know, and despite all of the trauma they may have encountered or may experience in the resettlement, the first stages, rely on in order to begin to thrive. And I think they're really protective factors. And then COVID-19 and the, you know, the requirement to socially distance, for us, it's actually been challenging to help some refugee families choose with social distancing over family connectivity, because, you know, that is their support system. And then for other families, you know, social isolation does mean, you know, as you were just talking about, sometimes the interpersonal dynamics get you know, challenged.
So do some of the refugees you work with? Yeah. Did someone want to jump in there? Carolyn? Did you want to jump in there, Carolyn, on the idea of the difficulty of social distancing and also the idea of resilience, Carolyn, in especially these times? I wonder what you're seeing.
Now, as African community, first of all, when we relocate with our parents, we relocate with our loved ones. So most of the families, you'll find one apartment has more than the usual number that is here in America, like a family has four. Sometimes here you'd find our families have like six. So with that, that makes the social distancing very challenging, especially if one or two of the family members is going to work and coming back.
Right.
That puts the others who are in the house at risk. So that is one of the challenge. And also most of the families we serve live in the Heights, and there is a lot of families that are living there. So it's also very congested. So you're going to do laundry, you're going out for shopping. It makes social distancing very difficult. And also if you're working in a factory, you're going to be many people in one place. If you're working in the housekeeping, maybe in the hospital, or in the hotel, it's also going to make it very challenging. So those are some of the challenges that our community is facing during this time.
Okay, so working in jobs that might put them more at risk, and then coming home, Carolyn, to large families. So there may be more of a spread there. Do you want to comment briefly, Carolyn, on the idea that some refugee communities are actually finding resilience in this time, given that, you know, they have experience with going through a tough time?
Of course, yeah. And one thing I would like to mention is that most of our foods from Africa are also very medicinal when it comes to things like flu, like coughing, like the challenges that the COVID-19 is bringing. So we are taking more of our natural foods as immigrants. And also in the refugee community, when you see some of the vegetables we are growing in our Fresh Start farm, some of them are medicinal, like the manogo. So we are finding those foods helping us to cope more during this time. And also, based on the fact that most of the refugees have gone through the trauma of war, of famine, of leaving their home country, coming to a new country and settling, that also has given a lot of resilience. So this just looks like one of the other things that other challenge thrown to the refugee community that can be addressed, because they've seen an end to living a life where you are in a war zone and then you come to another country where you are able to live a better life.
Well, all of you, we could have talked a lot longer. It's been really good to talk to the three of you this morning. Carolyn, thank you very much for being with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Carolyn Musimi-Kamau. She's manager for the New American Africans Program at the Organization for Refugee and Immigrant Success. And Clement, thank you also for being with us. We'll talk again.
Thank you.
That's Clement Kigugu. He's Chief Executive Officer at Overcomers Refugee Services. And Zan, thank you also for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Warren. Thank you for the Lifeline series. It's so amazing to bring so much attention to this part of our world and our country and in New Hampshire.
Great. Well, that's Zan Weber, Chief Program Officer and Social Worker for the International Institute of New England. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our executive producer is Michael Brindley. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Christina Phillips and Jessica Hunt. And our fellow is Jane Vaughn. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Thanks for being with us. I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.